I don't want to really get the myself and the rest of the speakers in too much trouble with respect to questions from the floor, but we have configured our presentations to try to explain the what the problems are and what's going on so that you'll understand. We don't get away very much with explaining to Joe that we would explain it to him, but he wouldn't understand. We kind of have to go back and do that. This is ends up being a thinking man's program with the thinking people at the center, at least some of the thinking people at the center doing the presentations, and all the people here are thinking people. The program office doesn't want to be a thinking man's filter. Joe didn't have any puns, so I'm allowed one. And I think that if there's a real question comes up during the papers that you'd like to stop and ask about, this would be fine, but I hope from the handout that you've been given that you'll understand what is coming up and wait for the appropriate area to be covered. Is Mr. Jenkins and Mr. Cohen here? Stand up a while so they can see you. That's Mr. Jenkins, and he's the guy that will take the pieces of paper if you've got some specific questions that are related to an individual's area of concern. And he'll see to it that we get you answers for them. I'd like to just give you a very brief outline, which is slightly different from what was in the handout, as to what I'm going to talk about. I was going to talk about the plateaus and a very gross mission description, of which almost all of you are very thoroughly familiar, and so I'll go through it very quickly. I'd like to spend a little time on planning for launch attempts, what some of the considerations are for catering for holds during the launch, and the lunar lighting, as this affects lunar lighting for the crew's ability to identify problems at the landing site. And this whole thing ties together in the mission as introduced by Joe, really. Then I'll go into mission description in a fair amount of detail, and I'm going to, some of the areas of the mission are like in the lunar area, lunar landing and lunar rendezvous, are covered in very considerable detail by speakers later on. I won't dwell on those hardly at all. I'll be talking more about the near-Earth parts of the mission and really leaving it to these other people to go into the great detail on the other parts. I was going to give a very brief weight summary at the module level at the end, and that really ought to be the total of my presentation. I'll get into the gross mission description. This section of the symposium will describe the first Apollo lunar landing mission in its entirety, from liftoff to recovery. It's intended to provide the general framework for proper understanding of the subsequent presentations, which will explore particular aspects of the mission in considerably greater detail. It's useful to think of the lunar landing mission as being planned in a series of steps or decision points separated by mission plateaus. The decision to continue to the next plateau is made only after an assessment of the spacecraft's present status and its ability to function properly on the next plateau. If after such an assessment it is determined that the spacecraft will not be able to function properly, then the decision may be made to proceed with an alternate mission. Alternate missions, therefore, will be planned essentially for each plateau. Similarly, on certain of the plateaus, including lunar stay, the decision may be made to delay proceeding in the mission for a period of time. In this respect, the mission is open-ended and considerable flexibility exists. We'll discuss this flexibility in detail as we describe the mission. The end points of these plateaus represent major commit points in the lunar landing mission and are characterized by propulsive maneuvers resulting in major changes in the spacecraft energy. These commit points and mission plateaus can both be represented schematically, and we've done this on a single chart here. This slide shows the major maneuver or commit points, launch, translunar injection. The commit points are identified along the bottom here. They are identified in both terms of delta V, which is up here, and the dashed bars show the delta V, and the weight of propellant on the right-hand side with the solid line. These maneuvers represent the commit points then across the bottom, and the space between represents the plateaus in between here. These are the same plateaus we looked at in the earlier slide. We'll discuss this slide in more detail, but first we'll add another slide on the other screen to complete the pictorial representation of the mission. The Earth, the Moon, and their relative movement through the mission are shown to scale in this slide in an Earth-centered coordinate system. The spacecraft's orbits about the Earth and Moon are, of course, not to scale, and I guess you can hardly see them. Our first plateau, the pre-launch phase, terminates at launch from the Cape. The launch to Earth orbit is performed with the first two stages and a partial burn of the third stage of the Saturn V, as shown on the left-hand side, and this is just for completeness because it's a fantastic amount of propellant compared to the other ones. The Earth ascent phase represents the major expenditure of propellant for the lunar landing mission, approximately 5.5 million pounds, as we see. We put 300,000 pounds or so into Earth orbit. Now, referring to the left-hand slide, the Earth ascent phase is shown schematically, as we might see it from some distant point in space, looking down on the Earth-Moon plane. The Moon's position at launch is shown in the lower right-hand corner, and its daily movement as the mission continues goes across here like so. Following the ascent, the spacecraft reaches the second plateau, Earth parking orbit. During each parking orbit, which can last up to 4.5 hours, spacecraft systems are checked out and made ready for the next major maneuver, which is translunar injection. As shown on the right-hand slide, translunar injection represents a considerable change in spacecraft energy. The velocity is increased some 10,000 feet a second and 150,000 pounds of propellant. From the second burn of, S4B stage. Following translunar injection, the spacecraft is on the next plateau, translunar coast. An initial period of ground tracking is performed to confirm that the spacecraft is on a satisfactory trajectory, and following this confirmation, the transposition and docking operation is performed. This operation involves the command service module separating from the rest of the configuration, turning around and docking on the lunar module, which is still attached to the S4B, and continuing to the translunar coast. Sufficient separation velocity is applied by the service module reaction control system to assure that there is no possibility of subsequent recontact with the S4B. The spacecraft continues to coast in the translunar leg of the trip for approximately the next 3 days, and two or three mid-course corrections will be made by the service propulsion system during the translunar coast phase to assure that the spacecraft arrives at the correct location for its next major burn, which is lunar orbit insertion. Now, the lunar orbit insertion maneuver occurs behind the Moon after the spacecraft has passed out of line of sight to the Earth. The maneuver is performed with the SPS and service propulsion system, requires approximately, gives approximately 3,500 feet a second and uses about 25,000 pounds of propellant. If the lunar orbit insertion maneuver is not performed for some reason, then the spacecraft merely circumnavigates the moon and returns to the Earth entry condition on the free return trajectory, which is shown in the dotted line here. And there are no SPS burns required to do that. The successful execution of the lunar orbit insertion maneuver, however, will have placed the spacecraft in a circular orbit about the moon at an 80 nautical mile altitude, about an 80 nautical mile altitude. And this is the next plateau. The lunar module is separated from the CSM, and the two crewmen begin their descent to the lunar surface, leaving a single crewman behind the command module. The initial deboost of the lunar module from its 80 nautical mile orbit is made behind the moon and is performed by a small impulse from the LEM descent engine. Following a coast period of about an hour, during which the lunar module has slowly descended to 50,000 feet, the descent engine is again ignited and the main braking maneuver is initiated. From this point, the descent to the surface requires about 10 minutes, the latter portion of which is under manual control of the crew. As noted in the right-hand slide, the fuel expenditure for this maneuver has been over 15,000 pounds, which is equivalent to a delta V of about 6,500 feet a second. Following the lunar landing, the crew will secure the lunar module, don their extravehicular life support equipment, and exit to the lunar surface. And during the 18-hour stay period, there will be two expiration periods of 3 hours each performed by both crewmen. The extravehicular activity will consist of sample collection and placement of the experiments package for long-term operation, photography, and general geological observation. Following the return from the last exploration period, the crew performs the pre-launch checkout of the lunar module systems and prepares for launch. At the proper time, with the CSM approximately 10 degrees ahead of the lunar module, the ascent engine is ignited, and the lunar module ascent stage lifts off from the moon, leaving the descent stage on the surface. Although the ascent trajectory involves several maneuvers from liftoff until rendezvous with the CSM is accomplished, the most significant of these is the powered ascent, which involves a continuous engine burn from the surface to burn out at 50,000 feet altitude. From the right chart, you can see that about 5,000 pounds of propellant is expended, with an equivalent delta V of about 6,000 feet a second. The conclusion of the main ascent burn at 50,000 feet is such that the lunar module is placed on a safe coasting trajectory, which will not impact the moon, even if the subsequent rendezvous maneuvers were not made for some reason. This leaves the lunar module in a relatively stable situation for which rescue by the CSM could be made if necessary. However, the planned ascent phase continues with a series of small impulses provided by the lunar module RCS, and rendezvous occurs with the CSM about 2 hours after liftoff. After the lunar module has docked in the CSM, the crew from the lunar module is transferred to the CSM, along with the data and samples collected on the lunar surface. The lunar module is then jettisoned and preparations are made for the next major maneuver, which is trans-Earth injection. In the meantime, the moon, of course, has moved along to there. As seen in the chart, the delta V requirement for trans-Earth injection is slightly less than for lunar orbit insertion, and the propellant expenditures for the SPS are considerably less than 8,000 pounds. Since the spacecraft is considerably lighter at this time. Now, it's of interest to note here, and perhaps this is out of position on the slide, but this is a good spot to show it, that until the lunar module began its descent operations, a backup for trans-Earth injection was available in the lunar module descent engine. This is considered a particularly useful capability since it allows us to guard against an SPS failure during its first major burn for lunar orbit insertion. For this reason, then, the propellant requirement for trans-Earth injection is also shown in terms of what would be required for the lunar module descent propulsion system, which is approximately 14,000 pounds. So it takes less if the SPS does that than if the descent propulsion system of the lunar module would do it. Of course, that particular operation with the descent propulsion system of the lunar module would do it would be done back before you went down to lunar descent. So up until you commit for lunar landing, you've got this capability, and we want to take advantage of it. Following the trans-Earth injection, the spacecraft is on a plateau, much like the outgoing leg of the trajectory to the moon. At least it's safe. It is targeted to arrive at a safe entry condition at the proper time to allow it to reach its primary recovery area in the Pacific Ocean. Small mid-course corrections during the trans-Earth coast assure that these conditions are reached. Shortly before arrival at the entry point, the service module is jettisoned and the command service module is oriented for entry. The entry range varies between 1,500 and 2,500 nautical miles and is controlled by rolling the command module during the entry phase to redirect its lift vector. At 25,000 feet altitude, the drogue parachutes are deployed and followed a short time later by the main parachutes, which slow the command module to touchdown conditions. Recovery is effected and the crew are aboard the ship and the mission is completed. Having completed this gross description of the total mission, we will now turn our attention to some basic mission planning considerations before we go into the detailed description of the mission. And here I'd like to talk about launch attempts from the Earth, the lighting conditions for landing at the moon, and the intervening accumulators that could contribute to a balanced planning scheme for a first manned landing attempt. Very briefly, you would say that it is highly desirable, highly advantageous, to allow at least 48 hours between each of two or even three scrubs. This isn't exactly every other day, but it could be allowing 2 or 3 days between scrubs according to what the particular geometry of the particular mission might provide. Now, we certainly require more than 1 2.5 hour launch window per month because there is a reasonably high probability of scrub against a particular scheduled time, and the resulting impact on the following program is high, and you'd like to avoid it, and therefore you'd like to get the vehicle off in that month. The causes of scrubs and holds are due to launch vehicle and spacecraft and launch complex or the manned spaceflight net systems problems, or possibly weather. The probability of scrub has historically, and for good reason, increased markedly after the time it becomes necessary to recycle in the event of a scrub. Historically, and again for good reason, recycle times are most frequently in excess of 24 hours and usually more than 48 hours. When they occur, they appear to occur in that way. The probability of scrub against a particular scheduled time is reasonably high, approximately a third, looking at the Saturn data to date. That's what the history has been. Now, the number isn't exactly a third, but if you use a third and think through the numbers a little bit, you'll find that the probability of launch, therefore, increases markedly as you allow multiple recycle opportunities, and it starts at 0.67 for no recycle, and 8.9 for one recycle, 0.96 for two recycles, and 0.99 for three recycles. And from this, it's highly advantageous, obviously, to provide some accumulator in the system to permit at least two and possibly three recycles of at least 48 hours each. Providing for the intervening days would increase the probability, would not increase the probability much because of the length of the recycle times. You should think now about what this will do at the moon if you had this kind of a launch situation, launching on the first, third, and fifth, or first, third, and sixth, or first, fourth, and allowing at least 48 hours between each attempt. Now, sun elevation at the moon changes a little more than 24 degrees in 48 hours, which would be the minimum time between these attempts. So that for two recycles, it would change 48 degrees, and for three, it would change 72 degrees. And as you recall, Dr. Shea indicated that our current mission planning is based on a sun elevation of 7 degrees to 20 degrees to take maximum advantage of the crew's visibility in the landing operation. The marked difference between the desired delta of 13 degrees and the deltas of 48 degrees and possibly 72 degrees associated with two or three recycle capabilities is significant. Additional Earth orbits, I'm going to talk now about some of the accumulators that might kind of make up for this difference. Additional Earth orbits or lunar orbits or changing the translunar transit time, any one of these three could be used as built-in holes at the rate of a half a degree per hour or three-quarters of a degree per Earth orbit and 1 degree per lunar orbit and 5 degrees if you increase the transit time an additional 10 hours. Earth orbit is limited to a few in number due to the current launch vehicle electrical power life being the order of 4.5 hours in Earth orbit and 2 hours which we've allowed for out to fill in for transposition and docking from injection through transposition and docking. The translunar transit time is not flexible when we are flying free return trajectories, and lunar orbit is the most significant accumulator for a built-in hold. It would take at least 70 hours of lunar orbit stay fully to rectify the lighting, and you would have to have pre-planned the first attempt that much early to build in the hold, like a built-in hold. Consumables and systems life would now become the problem with that long a time in lunar orbit. Now, this obviously leads us to look at multiple landing sites. Now, we have, of course, been involved with the Lunar Orbiter and Surveyor site selection people. The sites shown on this figure are from the Orbiter A sites and Orbiter B sites, as planned to be flown later this year. These particular ones, these aren't all of those sites, but these particular ones have been identified at this point in time as most probable to contain acceptable touchdown points and a large dispersion ellipse from the guidance, and to include considerations for radar approach terrain. The B sites are all across the top here, and the A sites, these are Orbiter A and Orbiter B, that's what the A's and B's mean. And here's Surveyor landing in this area, and they've moved orbiters A, 9, and 10 so that they will guarantee adequate coverage of that site to see if we can get correlation back through photography with the other sites. A scan of performance capability for a 95,000-pound spacecraft with 37,500 pounds of propellant and retaining about 1% of that in reserve for the service propulsion system shows the dates in 1968 when each site can be achieved with the 7 degrees to 20 degree sun elevation. I'll describe this chart a little bit. It's rather complex a lot of numbers on it, so I'll describe what they are generally. These are the orbiter site numbers that are indicated on the left-hand slide here. These are the ones that are the most advantageous of that whole group. I'm sorry, I think I said earlier that these were, I think there are a few orbiter A and B sites that aren't shown in here at all, but these are the ones that that we have scanned with the data that we have to date to understand what kind of a capability we'll have to find an acceptable landing site in them. The next row here shows the number of sites that that scan has indicated. So it says in that A1 site, we found at least two sites with the worst criteria we could dream up at this point. We found at least two areas in there that we could find a landing spot, and so forth, three here. Once in a while, I find one that we can only find one place that we can cram in this big ellipse and the big radar tail. These things will be talked about later on, or defined what they are in detail. Now, the point that I want to make with these two charts at this time is that this group, A1 through A3, and here's A1 and here's A3, is a little cluster over on the right-hand side in the Sea of Tranquility. And when you look down here on the chart below, here we have, these are days of the month in here, and this is starting in January, so that's January the 31st, and then February the 1st and so forth coming across here. These are days in the month when those sites are able to be achieved with that performance capability we discussed and with that lighting condition we discussed. And the N on this chart means that you have a night launch from Earth. So as you proceed across here in the month, you'll end up having to launch at night in order to get to that point. So that's the similar situation as we go down here. And we'll find that down here that we have a difficult time in the latter part of the year getting to those western sites with this performance capability. If we used up some of the reserve, we no doubt could improve the situation a little bit, but we'll talk a little later about how that area might be covered. I think the continuing with the point of the cluster over here in the east, and then the next group, B6, A5, and B8, B6, A5, and B8 is a cluster here in the center. And then B10, A8, B11, and A9. B10, A8 over here, and A10 would be in the same group, are over in the west. And in between them, in this region, and in this region, the terrain is really quite rough, and we would have a difficult time finding an acceptable landing site in there, and that's what our scans have indicated. So now when we look at the situation on the right here, we find that, lo and behold, that, say, in February, if subsequent scans of these sites indicate that any one of these things is acceptable, let's pick that one, for instance. Well, I think, as a matter of fact, okay, we'll just pick this B3, for instance, that there is a day... if you had a scrub when you planned to fly to this one, you've got all this time from the 1st to the 3rd to pick up any one of these other ones in here. And over here, you've even got an additional day. And then if something happens that you have to recycle in this launch attempt, that you've got a couple of days to get to this one. And if this one here turned out to be the acceptable, most acceptable site, and... as we see here, it's got four potentials in it, that you've got 3 days. So these kind of flexibilities between attempts are, I think, real fine things to have, and it was, the way I look at it, was real fortunate that nature arranged it that way. Now, changes of the magnitude of sun elevation would obviously shift the days, since we're talking about 7 degrees to 20 degrees was the constraint in putting out that scan. Increases in the range of sun elevation would increase the opportunities, and decreases in the range of sun elevation would decrease the opportunities. So I haven't got the data here, but obviously if you cut down the constraint real narrow, you'd be losing some of those days that you could go. This might be rectified by a few additional lunar orbits that you had pre-planned, and you could gain them back again. We see here then that for Pacific injections, we have a considerable number of potential sites clustered in the three groups with at least 48 hours between the groups. Now here we have shown the Atlantic injections, or using Atlantic injections, and this business of a Pacific injection and Atlantic injection, what they are and what they mean, will be dealt in great detail by Pete Franks later on. But over here on the left side, we show the performance scan associated with Atlantic injections. And one of the things to note here is, and Pete will point this out no doubt, is that these are all night launches. Over here, we had, going out of the Pacific, that we were able to launch a fair amount of the time during the day, and at least our first attempts are always during the day, and we've only got this one that isn't. Now, you see here where we had some holes here that we might have difficulty getting off in this, the latter part of the year, because we don't have, if some of these, say that 28 site were to fail, we'd have a big long gap in here where we couldn't launch in September. So we come over here and we find that, well, here's a situation, we would go out of the Atlantic in order to perform the mission. We'd have to live with the night launch in that case. Now, the distribution of a scan of this same type is not markedly different when you look at 1967 and 1969. The dates shift back and forth, but the same kind of a thing would hold, and you would be able to find an opportunity, capability to go any 3 days of the month with these appropriate times between them. Now, this next slide shows how the Earth, Moon, and Sun cooperate to give us a reasonable mission concept, allowing the 2 48-hour recycle times at the launch pad and near optimum lighting at the Moon. The precise targeting points would have to be determined. We won't have to determine them until about 6 months prior to the mission, so that we can get the targeting all squared away. But for the purpose of illustration here, I've chosen the A3, A5, and A8 sites in February. So that would be like that one. A5 is that one. And A8 is that one. And it says night launch there, and I have to check up on that. I'm just not absolutely certain that that's so. I'll get Pete to check up on that for me. Here we have shown as well for this planning what the actual sun elevation at landing turns out to be, and you can see it's well within the 7 to 20 degree envelope. We see that the reason that night launches kind of tend to happen is that the sun ends up being over here, and here we have the arrangement of the moon for the first attempt, and here's the way it would look for the second attempt, and the angles between the Earth and the moon are right, but the distance between them are not to scale. So this is that first attempt at the mission, and there's your landing point that you're aiming for, and here's the second attempt, and here's the landing point that you're aiming for, the second one. And here's the third attempt, and it's away over at the west. Up here. The third landing attempt is away over the west, so there's a lot of additional time between these two sites. So the first hold, you'd have at least a day to fix things up, and here you've got more than that time. Now, this is, again, just typically a particular time set that we're looking at, and I don't want to give anybody the impression that that's the day that it's going to happen. The scientific objectives of at least the early mission have been developed so that they may be achieved virtually independent of the site location. And we have to keep site selection in perspective as we get additional data. But we will have to focus, I think rather quickly, on a few sites as we approach the mission, because we can't continue to plan for that great number of sites all the time. I think at this point you could say that we are planning for all of those, although we are doing targeting studies largely on the ones over here that are shown on the left. Now, next I'd like to get into a detailed description of the mission. And I would just like to leave this one with the... I believe I've explained most of the arguments that lead us to believe that this at least 48 hours between attempts is a good and acceptable thing, but we will have to have the multiple site capability at the moon, and obviously the first attempts are going to be for over on the east side of the moon. Now we'll get into the detailed description of the mission. It's well to spend a few moments here, I think, on the orientation of the vehicle on the launch pad. The crew's heads, and the launch vehicle position are pointing east. This is in the easterly direction, and the crew's head is over. Crew's heads are pointing over in this direction. Their feet are going towards the plus Z axes, and X axis is forward, and Y is over to the right. It's a right-hand rule system. The inner gimbal of both spacecraft and launch vehicle IMUs are aligned normal to the upcoming orbital plane. The launch escape vehicle trajectory would take the command module over the water in case of an abort. And I think that kind of sets most of the considerations for the orientation at liftoff. Liftoff occurs after a 6-second hold-down period following engine ignition. During this time, the thrust of the first stage, which is powered by the five F1 engines, is built up to its rated value of 7.5 million pounds. The thrust-to-weight ratio of the vehicle is 1.25 at this time, so its initial ascent acceleration is quite small. The space vehicle rises vertically from the launch pad until the mobile launcher is cleared. It then performs a roll maneuver to align the launch vehicle position 1 along the desired launch azimuth, which can vary between 72 degrees and 180 degrees from north. The orientation on the pad was, you recall, such that the position was pointing, the position 1 was pointing east, so it will have to roll to the right or the left. Following the vertical rise period, which lasts about 12 seconds, a program pitch is commanded, which will continue throughout the first stage burn. The maximum dynamic pressure of 700 pounds per square foot is reached about 84 seconds later at an altitude of 43,000 feet. The inboard engine cutoff of the first stage will occur about 155 seconds after liftoff and will be followed by the outboard engine's cutoff 4 seconds later. During this first stage operation, the spacecraft will obtain an altitude of 200,000 feet, 30.3 nautical miles, and I don't have the number in meters, and it'll be about 66 nautical miles downrange. Maximum acceleration will have occurred at this point, amounting to about 4.5 Gs. Tracking and communications will have been continuous during this period with the ground-based facilities in the Cape area and with the facilities at Grand Bahama during the latter portion of the burn. And so we see the ground facilities and the insertion ship out here, and we'll talk about that later. Following cutoff of the outboard engines of the first stage, thrust decay to 10% occurs in about a half a second, at which time the second stage ullage rockets and first stage retro rockets are fired, and the S1-CS2 separation occurs. And so here we see him way back there. The S2 stage is powered by 5 J2 engines, each having 200,000 pounds of thrust. The thrust buildup to the rated value occurs rapidly and gets up there about 163 seconds after liftoff. And approximately 25 seconds after S2 ignition, the S1C-S2 forward interstage is jettisoned, and this is followed by the launch escape system jettison 5 seconds later. Now, up until this point, the launch escape system has been the means of safely removing the command module and crew away from a malfunctioning vehicle in the event an abort is necessary. The high thrust, 150-some thousand pounds, gives us a capability for the, well, is required to accomplish the safe abort during the atmospheric phase of the flight. Largely overcome the drag loads and the high or short times that we'd like to get away from the vehicle. At this point, when we jettison this launch escape vehicle, the service propulsion system has the capability to abort the spacecraft off the launch vehicle, so the launch escape system is jettisoned. The boost protective cover is attached to the launch escape system and is jettisoned at the same time. That's this cover here. The boost protective cover is a semi-soft fiberglass construction. It's hard up in the apex area and less hard down at the around the skirt. Its function has been to absorb the command module aerodynamic heating during boost and to provide a protective shield to maintain a satisfactory thermal control surface during the rest of the mission back to entry. Now, the actual jettison operation of the launch escape system, however, produces another thermal problem that the cover was protecting against. The exhaust products of the solid motors, tower jettison motors, will impinge on the clean surface of the command module and the service module and degrade the thermal performance to some extent anyway. The complete nature of this problem is being investigated, of course, in ground tests and in analysis, and we are continuing investigation in the early development flights to understand the nature of this. We will be available to discuss this in greater detail later, although there isn't a planned part of the presentation to do this, that if there's sufficient attention, we can talk about that later. The second stage burn continues for a total duration of about 375 seconds, a little more than 6 minutes. At this point, we are about 9 minutes into the mission. We have essentially reached orbital altitude of 100 nautical miles, but are still short of orbital velocity by about 3,000 feet per second. Our inertial velocity here is 22,650 feet per second. We're almost 900 nautical miles downrange from the Cape. The tracking station at the Cape, all the stations there, are out of range by this time, but other stations at Grand Turk or Bermuda have picked up the space vehicle, so that communications have not been interrupted. Now, following shutdown of the 5 J2 engines on the S2 stage, the S2-S4B separation occurs, and the third stage operations begin using the S4B stage. The separation sequence is similar to the one described for the S1C-S2 stage separation. Now, the S2 retro rockets and S4B ullage rockets fire And pyrotechnic devices, of course, separate the stages. And the problem that we mentioned previously on thermal coating degradation from the launch escape system jettison motors is similar to one which occurs here during the S2-S4B separation, in that the S2 retro rockets, and the plume isn't shown nearly big enough here, that these gases impinge on the service module, thereby degrading its thermal coating up in here. As we mentioned previously, this problem is under investigation in ground test analysis and flight test. The S4B burn during the boost phase lasts for about 2.5 minutes and imparts about 3,000 feet a second to the spacecraft velocity, boosting it up to the orbital velocity of about 25,600 feet a second. The thrust of the S4B stage is about 200,000 pounds and is produced by the single J2 engine. At the conclusion of the S4B burn, we are at the 100 nautical mile altitude and have traveled another 600 nautical miles downrange. So we're about 1,500 downrange total now. And the total ascent has taken about 11.5 minutes. During this third stage burn, we have lost communications with our land-based stations, but have been acquired by the insertion ship, which has been specifically located to fill in this gap and to provide a period of tracking immediately after insertion for the purposes of confirming a safe orbit. The insertion ship is located there. And at this time, the decision would be issued as to whether or not to continue the mission. Following this confirmation of this slide will be discussed later by the communications people and by Pete Franks, and I won't go into it in any more detail here. Following this confirmation of a good orbit, we arrive at our second mission plateau, which was discussed earlier as the Earth orbit plateau. The capability exists to spend up to 3 complete revolutions in the Earth parking orbit, but normally we will plan to execute our next commit point, which is translunar injection, during the second revolution. The limitation of 3 revolutions is associated with considerations of S4B consumables. To answer all the questions about orbit stay time capability, you have to understand how extensive a set of operations we require during this parking orbit. So we'll consider some of these operations now. I will only talk about the operations briefly for the near-Earth activities, and I won't even cover them all for this Earth orbit. It would be too time-consuming, I think. Anybody would like to talk about them in more detail, we can go into them later. Immediately after the S4B cutoff at Earth orbit insertion, the launch vehicle propellant tanks are vented of hydrogen and oxygen gases to relieve the pressure buildup. And this is performed at this time so to prevent unpredictable vents from interfering with the sensitive attitude operations later on. The venting sequence is preceded by Ullage rocket firing to assure propellant settling so that only the vapors are vented. After settling the propellant, the oxygen tanks are vented for about 15 seconds. Hydrogen venting will be done continuously throughout Earth orbit along the spacecraft's thrust axis. However, the propulsive force of the hydrogen venting only amounts to about 7 pounds and therefore would not interfere with other operations during Earth orbit. There is now in the mission a considerable amount of activity associated with navigation and crew activities, which will be touched on by later speakers, and this is the part that I will not dwell on. The chart on the left shows the Earth trace for a typical mission. As a matter of fact, it's that first mission that we looked at when we had the 3 of them shown on the left-hand side here. Let me just walk through the mission quickly on this chart. It will be shown later to identify what these different stations will do for you, but we lift off here, we go out in Assertion here, and Canary Islands here, Ascension down here. This particular trajectory would take you over Canary Islands, and if we launch down south, we would go over Ascension. If we're in between, we sometimes pass in between these two, and you don't have a good tracking capability in that region. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. Anyway, we proceed down here, and we pick up over here in the just west of Australia, and come over Carnarvon, Canberra, and on up through. There's a ship located here, another ship here, and up over into the area of the continental United States. And the several stations are shown here. We continue down and come up here, and then at this time we're starting translunar insertion. And there is ship number 2 is located here for that insertion, number 3 here, and so forth. And then we go out here, and we're on our way up to the moon now, and this trace goes back and forth. And then down here comes the trace when we're coming back from the moon, and the touchdown area is in here, and the reentry ship is located here. And I think that that is a reasonable introduction to that chart, and you will see it a few times later on. Now, the actual commit point for translunar injection, well, this is the translunar injection. The commit point occurs back in here. It occurs about 7 minutes before the S4B ignition, and since this is the period required for the S4B restart sequence. Now, this sequence initiation may be inhibited by the crew if it is decided to delay injection until the next orbit. But once the sequence is started on a given orbit, it is not possible to delay injection to the next orbit. The sequence can, of course, be terminated at any time, but the limitations on S4B consumables, which are associated with the chill down and with the ullage propellants, do not allow a second opportunity. Now, these considerations of tracking, spacecraft checkout, IMU alignment, data transmission and analysis that we've been after in Earth orbit, therefore make it unlikely that translunar injection would be able to occur on the first Pacific opportunity, which would be when we're coming down like about in this region. Well, at least when this point lies over the Western Pacific, this would be particularly difficult to achieve. It may be practical, however, to make the first Pacific opportunity when the injection points are in the eastern part of the Pacific, and this does occur on some occasions. This is being looked at, therefore, at the present time, and there appears to be no real strong reason why it could not be accomplished. Now, the advantage to performing the mission to inject as early as possible would be to allow maximum time within the 4.5-hour limitations for the S4B in Earth orbit to correct temporary malfunction of either the onboard systems or the ground systems. For purposes of our mission description, however, we assume that we plan to inject on the second Pacific opportunity. We continue in the Earth orbit, passing over the Pacific Ocean, over Hawaii Station, and finally coming up on the west coast of the United States.
This is a good plateau. We might take a coffee break just before
okay.
You do your insertion.
All right. Okay. Across the United States, the tracking is continuous by stations at Goldstone, Corpus Christi, and Cape Kennedy. If we are not trying for an early injection, we can perform a series of landmark sightings in Earth orbit to test our ability to perform the same type of navigation when we get to the moon. And the S-4B reaction control system provides the propellant and the capability for this. Voice communications, data transmission, and tracking continue during the second orbit. Another IMU alignment is performed 15 minutes before the planned injection time. The go decision is given by the ground, and the crew secures the spacecraft. The S-4B restart sequence begins. The Ullage rockets are fired, and the vehicle is ready for translunar injection. Now, Dr. Shea suggests that we stop here for a coffee break, and I'm all for that. 15 minutes, Joe? 10 minutes? Okay.
Are you on your timeline, or are you running behind?
I'm pretty good. Okay. Yeah, I've scratched out an awful lot of stuff. I think that's the right kind of...
Yeah, thank you, because you might move it just a little bit. After you put it in the detail, you're going back and sort of explaining what it's going to be explained.
Well, when I moved it last night, I just plain read it, and...
All right. I see our speaker surrounded and now making his way to the podium. Breaking away from the adoring crowds. Think he was an astronaut. There is, in addition to the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, another very famous attraction called the Astrodome. Which they've upgraded recently by putting a reasonable ball club in there. And it's one of the wonders of the world that the team is called the Astros, as you probably know, and they stay remarkably close to the first division, and they seem to be winning somewhat more than half their games. We hope we have equivalent success in our missions later on. We have arranged for the member or attendees at the sessions to go down there tonight if you'd like to go. I believe they're playing the cards, and they won last night and they lost the night before. I'm not sure who's pitching or any of that kind of stuff. But we have set up for a bus to leave here, the auditorium, at about 6 o'clock. Turns out there are several restaurants in the Astrodome. You could eat down there, and then the buses will bring you back to the local motels in the center after the game. Those of you who would like to go should really log your names. And, Bob, I guess there's a place out there to do it, huh? At the luncheon break, and we'll have the tickets reserved for you down there. We need to have the decisions made by 1 o'clock on who wants to go. Okay.
During the approximately 5.5 minutes of S-4B burn for translunar injection, the spacecraft velocity will have been increased by more than 10,000 feet a second. The altitude will have increased to about 160 nautical miles, and about 50 degrees to 60 degrees of longitude will have been traversed. Tracking by ground-based stations during the translunar injection will be available on many missions. But due to the large envelope of translunar injection points, tracking even with ships will not always be possible. In any case, however, the spacecraft will be acquired and tracked by an MSFN station
within no more than 7 or 8 minutes after translunar injection. However, voice communications and data transmission will be maintained during the injection phase by means of relay aircraft. Having completed translunar injection, we are now on the next plateau, which is called Translunar Coast. Immediately after injection, the hydrogen and oxygen tanks of the S-4B will be vented to a low pressure to assure that uncontrolled venting will not occur during the critical attitude operations for the next two-hour period. These vents are done non-propulsively so that they do not perturb the spacecraft trajectory. Following a quick systems status check after the end of injection, the first operation will be for the crew to reorient the vehicle in a direction favorable for docking illumination, while at the same time maintaining communications with the Earth during the next two-hour period. And here represents an Earth station, and the communications, as we'll talk about later, are from the S4 antennas located here that we want to get communications back to here. And as the vehicle continued out on that trajectory, you'd hit a dead band behind it that the ground stations, you'd lose contact with the ground stations. One additional constraint is that the maneuver sequence for this reorientation must avoid yawing the vehicle more than plus or minus 45 degrees so as not to result in gimbal lock for the S4B inertia platform. For the sun position in the 7 to 20 degree range at lunar landing, the transposition and docking operations will be in daylight, as shown in this slide, so that I guess there are heads on the ends of those arrows, but the sunlight is coming from here. The reorientation maneuver will be such that the sun is incident on the lunar module docking tunnel for best visibility. The maneuver then is such that the vehicle is pitched through about 60 degrees, and at this point, both the spacecraft and the launch vehicle are communicating over their S-band Omni antennas, which in fact have a 30 degree to 40 degree null zone in both the front and the back. In a short time, however, about 15 minutes after injection, the S-4B communications will be switched automatically from the Omnis to directional antennas. So we have to account for this in the reorientation maneuver. Therefore, following the 60-degree pitch, there must be approximately 180-degree roll maneuver to place the launch vehicle directional antenna in the proper position for transmission when the switchover is made. Now, the antenna back here was pointing toward the Earth. And so when you do this pitch maneuver here, it ends up pointing out this way. So you have to do a roll maneuver to get it back to the Earth. Actually, the pitch and roll maneuver will be done simultaneously, constrained or subject to the gimbal lock considerations that we talked of earlier. As discussed in the early orbit, in the Earth orbit phase, these maneuvers are performed at low rates in order not to require an excessive amount of S4B reaction control system propellant. During this period of reorientation, the Earth will have acquired the vehicle and tracking will have been continuous except for a brief period during the 60-degree maneuver when the Omni antenna null zone swept through the ground station. So during this pitch over here, the null zone goes through the station and you lose contact. A tracking period of about 10 minutes will be required for the ground to accurately determine the vehicle's orbit and to provide a go decision for transposition and docking to proceed. Now that loss there of the dead band going sweeping through the station, if the roll and pitch maneuver are done in a certain manner, you can in fact maintain contact on certain of the missions, but you can't do it always. Now, having received the decision to proceed with transposition and docking, the command service module separates from the S4B lunar module combination using the service module reaction control system, like so. This separation severs the hardline control interface between the crew and the S-4B. Now, any further maneuvers of the S-4B will need to come from the ground command. However, the orientation we selected before separation was one which will not require any adjustments in attitude, at least for the first hour, during which the transposition and docking would normally be completed. Our present plans are to place the vehicle in an inertial attitude hold mode before the separation. It's oriented so that the launch vehicle directional antennas continue to see the ground station as the spacecraft trajectory sweeps through about 45 degrees of central angle during the next 45 minutes. During this period, the S-4B directional antenna has been switched to its narrow beam, but communications are maintained. During the second hour of the transposition and docking phase, which is provided for contingencies, it may be necessary to reorient the S-4B from the ground to maintain communications with the launch vehicle. Returning to the transposition and docking sequence, we see representation of the separation maneuver in the next slide, showing the command module pulling away from the S-4B LEM combination. The adapter panels were deployed as part of the separation sequence and are held at a 45-degree angle with respect to the longitudinal axis. This is sufficient to clear the lunar module and allow a clean extraction maneuver. Had the panels been folded back completely, right back here, they would have covered up the antennas back here on the S-4B instrument unit. The service module reaction control system is used to translate some 100 feet away from the S-4B, and at this point the translation is stopped, and the command module is rolled to the proper indexing for docking and then pitched 180 degrees so that it is pointing back at the lunar module. The roll pitch sequence rather than a pitch roll sequence is used to avoid placing a spacecraft on the antenna null zone at the MSFN station during the 180 degree pitch maneuver. Spacecraft omnis are located up here in the base of the command module. In the case of the spacecraft, we must avoid yaw maneuvers greater than plus or minus 70 degrees to avoid gimbal lock. Unlike maneuvers during the rest of the mission, the turnaround is done at the rapid rate of 5 degrees a second in order to reduce the time required for transposition docking, and in particular to minimize the time the crew is out of line of sight of the launch vehicle in the separated condition. Having turned around, the crew will now deploy the spacecraft high-gain steerable antenna, or during the turnaround, and orient it to Earth before closing on the LEM lunar module for docking. This is required because the spacecraft omni antennas will be blanked by the adapter pedals once the command service module gets in close to the lunar module for docking. Therefore, communications with the spacecraft will have to be maintained using the high-gain antenna. Now, the docking operation continues under the manual control of the spacecraft crew as the final translation is made and the command service module slowly closes on the LEM S-4B. Initial contact is made when the docking probe on the command module engages the drogue mounted on the lunar module. The docking mechanism pulls the two vehicles firmly together and the final few inches. Four latches automatically engage, and the initial soft docking is completed. Now, the next step will be to manually hook up the command module, lunar module umbilicals. In this area, there are two umbilicals in there, completely redundant. And complete the latching operation by manually engaging eight more latches, so that there was some structural integrity there, and now we achieve complete integrity with a total of 12 latches in there. Now, this is a schematic representation of the docking indexing. The command service module, this slide had some artwork done on it this morning, so that's what these black lines there. The command service module, lunar module axes are offset by 60 degrees in the docked configuration. Now here's the plus Z axes of the lunar module, and here's the minus Z axis of the CSM, so they're 60 degrees apart, and you'll wonder why. Now this allows the command module pilot to line up on the docking target located in the lunar module. Now this is the docked configuration, so you're looking at it as if you're in the command module, and you're looking out that window right there, and you're looking at the target on the lunar module. Similarly, when docking in lunar orbit, this indexing will allow the lunar module pilot to see the docking target mounted in the command module right-hand window. Now here's the command module right-hand window over here, and this is the front of the lunar module, and that window above the lunar module pilot's head is right there, so he'll be looking up into the right-hand window. And this is where the docking aid is located, and that is part of the reason why this particular orientation has turned out this way. Now, also shown in the diagram is the command service module high-gain antenna, which, unless the pitch attitude is properly selected, will be shrouded by the attitude panels, or if the roll attitude, the indexing attitude, weren't selected right, it could be completely over the panels. It's not completely clear, but by controlling the pitch attitude, you can get perfectly adequate communications. Now, the S4B high-gain antenna is located in the same quadrant. It is actually located in this general area here, so that the S4B would be oriented with this direction back to Earth. The sun would be coming like from the over in that corner of the auditorium, and it would have a component coming down this way, so that the pilot, when he's looking out this window, will be able to see corners of this part of the adapter, and he'll be able to see the docking target, obviously. But when he's doing his extraction maneuver, he will have some part of the adapter that he can look at to understand how he's moving away from the S4B stage. Now, after completion of the hard docking, the lunar module attachment ties are severed, and this is done, well, it's one of the reasons that we had to hook up the umbilical. We do not use an RF link, we use the umbilical hard line. And the separation is done using the service module reaction control system to back away. And we get about 3 feet a second separation velocity applied by the reaction control system. And this is sufficiently high to virtually assure no problem of subsequent recontact with the S4B. It's done in not in all one set of thrusting, but in like 5 seconds on, 5 seconds off, and 5 seconds on. Now, it would be well here to point out a general characteristic of the Apollo spacecraft, namely its large radius of gyration in pitch and yaw, and its small value in roll. And this being the lunar vehicle, it is not close coupled as Mercury and Gemini, except in roll. Now, 1 degree per second rate, if you want to achieve 1 degree per second rate, it costs you 11 pounds if you do it in pitch, 11 pounds of reaction control propellant. And it costs you 11 pounds in yaw as well. And it only costs you 1 pound in roll. And that's to start and stop. And a 5 degree per second rate referred to earlier, that pitch maneuver, costs almost 50 pounds of propellant. Now, this is a large price to pay for that simple maneuver, but the experience tells us not to spend large times remote from the station-keeping target, and we want to get around and see that thing quickly as well. But it is illustrative of the cost per maneuver. This cost leads us to pre-plan maneuvers to take advantage of the low inertia in roll and to think through each maneuver to minimize the propellant consumption. Now, this frugal use of reaction control system reactant is mandatory until the possible requirement for lunar module rescue has passed. At this point, because there's a very large amount of reaction control system propellant required in some of those contingency cases. At this point, we are about, that really concludes the discussion of reaction control system propellant utilization. It is a very lengthy discussion to get into it in its complete detail about what all of the maneuvers are and how we design them to minimize the use of propellant. We have this study, I believe, very well in hand, and would be happy to go over it with those that are interested. Now, at this point in the mission, we are about 1 hour past the translunar injection point at an altitude of about 9,000 nautical miles. The inertial velocity is decreased to about 23,000 feet per second, or about 13,000 feet per second less than we had at injection cutoff. The velocity will, of course, continue to decrease for most of the trip until we get near the moon's gravitational influence, and it starts to make us go the other way. The spacecraft is now being tracked by one of the three deep space stations with 85-foot dishes. These are at Madrid, Canberra, and Goldstone, as you probably recall. These will be discussed later by Mr. Broom as to what their capabilities are and so forth. They'll also be tracked by two of the unified S-band stations with the 35-foot dishes. Similar tracking coverage will be available throughout the rest of the mission back to entry, except for periods when we are behind the moon. Now, the first mid-course correction will be made in about 2 hours after the spacecraft's trajectory has been accurately determined by extensive ground tracking. During this period, the crew will make a series of star landmark sightings to check out their space mode of navigation, which is a backup to the ground navigation. The time of the first mid-course correction is not a critical event. Well, the time is not critical. Delaying the correction will, of course, allow the initial injection errors to grow so that a large delta V will be required for the injection once it is made. However, it is not extremely sensitive in the range of 3 to 5 hours after injection. In some cases, we will even prefer to wait if the injection has been particularly good. The delta V required for the early correction may be so low that we could not perform it accurately with the 20,000-pound thrust service propulsion system. If it's less than 4 feet a second, we really couldn't do it with the SPS at that time. Such small corrections could be made with the service module reaction control system engines, but we prefer to conserve the reaction control system propellant wherever possible, even at the expense of the service propulsion system propellant, when our reserves are considerably greater in the SPS than they are in the RCS. So we will trade off in that direction. The typical mid-course correction, then, will be done with the SPS about 3 hours after translunar injection and will require a delta V of about 25 feet a second. This is based on our analysis of the expected injection accuracies. Now, this corresponds to about 3 seconds of burn time by the SPS and could occur in any direction. Now, following the mid-course correction, we begin to set things up for the long coast period ahead. Another correction is not expected to be required until we get near the moon about 2.5 days later. The first operation to be performed is to orient the spacecraft for passive thermal control. Now, the object of passive thermal control is, of course, to ensure that critical components of the spacecraft do not get too hot or too cold during the long coast period. We refer to passive thermal control by the less technical but more descriptive term of barbecuing. The orientation maneuver is made such that the spacecraft longitudinal axis is placed perpendicular to the vehicle sun line. The orientation of the longitudinal axis about the sun vector is chosen to minimize the interference of the subsequent roll maneuver with high-gain antenna coverage. After stabilizing the spacecraft in this orientation, a slow rotational rate about the x-axis is established to achieve the desired thermal cycling. As a result of small residual rates about all the other axes, when we stabilize the spacecraft, and as a result of other sources of disturbances such as fuel slosh and venting, the vehicle will begin slowly to precess about its angular momentum vector. Now, the current analysis indicate that a rate of about 2.5 revolutions per hour will be required in order to maintain the spacecraft YZ plane. That would be a plane like that, enveloped by the two axes normal to this axis. We want to keep that plane within 20 degrees of the sun line, which essentially, when you're turning, it lets the sun alternately shine on and the heat shield surface here, for instance, and it doesn't see cold space for extensive periods of time. It's emphasized that the, or should be emphasized, that the thermal cycling operation can be interrupted for periods of up to 3 hours, provided these attitude holds are followed by an appropriate period of barbecuing, 5 to 7 times the hold period. Now, in addition, the thermal design is such that a 3 hour period prior to lunar orbit insertion and prior to entry can be accommodated without the necessity of subsequent thermal cycling. Now, following the establishment of our barbecue mode, operations onboard the spacecraft will settle down to a routine for the next 2.5 days. Now, periodic system status checks will be performed by the crew. The spacecraft's position and velocity will continue to be monitored by the ground. Data would be transmitted continuously by the spacecraft. The sun's position, such as to give us a 7-degree to 20-degree elevation angle at lunar landing, it turns out that we can usually set up the thermal roll maneuver to provide continuous coverage of the ground station with the high-gain antenna during the translunar coast phase, except for lunar landing sites west of about 20 degrees west longitude, which is getting over in that area of that western group of sites. Now, this would not be the case for the trans-Earth phase, but the situation is not considered a problem since the ground station, because of its higher radiative power, will always be able to contact the spacecraft over the Omni antennas and require or request that the roll maneuver be discontinued for a period if continuous or special communications were required for some reason. I should say here that the barbecue maneuver isn't the only thing we're looking at for thermal control, that our analyses are being directed toward trying to understand if we can operate in a rather random orientation so that we can understand more, we can have more flexibility in how we might perform the mission. A second mid-course correction will be made about 1 hour after entering the moon's sphere of influence, which is several hours before you reach lunar orbit. It is expected that this will be done with the SPS in the same manner described previously. Now, following another rest period, the crew begins a period of considerable activity, which will continue for the next several hours through lunar landing and the first exploration period. These activities will be discussed in detail in a later paper by Mr. Loftus, but we will mention the highlights here. About 3 hours before lunar orbit insertion, the lunar module will be checked out. And for this particular mission, the first lunar landing mission, We believe that this is an important thing to do. You wouldn't necessarily do this all the time on future missions. We'll discuss a little later about why this is a good thing to do, but I think it's probably new to quite a few people. At this time, we are considering this to be a requirement, and we haven't identified any reasons why we should not do it. Of course, this cuts into lunar surface stay time, but we believe that this is the advantageous direction for the trade-off, to get this thing checked out early. After pressurizing the lunar module, which has leaked down during the long coast period, one of the three crew members will transfer to the lunar module through the tunnel and begin an activation and checkout of the lunar module systems. Now, this checkout is considered desirable for really at least two things. First, it provides the people on the ground and the flight crew with the first knowledge since leaving the launch pad that the lunar module systems will indeed be able to function properly for a lunar landing. The discovery of some system malfunction which would preclude lunar landing may be sufficient reason not to commit the mission to lunar orbit. The second reason for lunar module checkout prior to lunar orbit is to assure that the descent propulsion system is available as a ready means of abort in the event of an SPS failure during lunar orbit insertion. Now, since the abort mode using the descent propulsion system also requires the use of the lunar module guidance and control system, it would be necessary to activate, check out, and align this system also. Now, similarly, the environmental control and electrical power systems would need to be activated. A second crewman would join the first when freedom from his duties in the command module would permit. There would be actually a fair amount of checkout going on there as well. The third crewman in the command module is occupied with preparations for lunar orbit insertion. The IMU is aligned, the state vector update is received from the ground and inserted into the computer, and a series of star landmark sightings are made to check out the onboard navigation backup capability. Continuous ground tracking confirms that we are indeed on the proper course and the decision is made to proceed to lunar orbit insertion. The lunar module crew is back in the command module by this time, and the next operation is to orient for lunar orbit insertion and prepare the spacecraft for SPS thrusting. A few minutes later, sunset occurs, and shortly thereafter, we pass out of line of sight to the Earth. 3 or 4 minutes after we go behind the moon, SPS ignition occurs for lunar orbit insertion. The spacecraft altitude at this point is typically 150 nautical miles. The burn duration for the lunar orbit insertion is typically somewhat over 6 minutes for a delta V of about 3,500 feet a second. Corresponding SPS propellant for this maneuver is about 24,000 pounds. During the insertion maneuver, the spacecraft has traveled through a central angle of about 20 degrees and ends up in a circular orbit of about 80 nautical miles altitude. During the insertion, a plane change was executed to make the orbit inclination such that the spacecraft orbit passes directly over the intended landing site on the third revolution. This situation allows us to make an in-plane descent with the lunar module on this third pass. We are now on another plateau, which is lunar orbit coast. The command service module and lunar excursion module will remain in the attached condition in lunar orbit for the next 5.5 hours. During this time, we will have made 3 passes over the front side of the moon and will have been tracked by the Earth on each pass. Now, this will have been more than sufficient to determine accurately what the orbit is. In order to reduce our uncertainty as to the selenographic position and altitude of our landing site, and to enhance our confidence in our onboard capability, we will also have taken a series of onboard landmark sightings in the vicinity of the landing site during two of these passes. And this point will be discussed in more detail in the paper on LEM descent. Now, these sightings are done, again, as we talked earlier, about using roll maneuvers. We can organize the orientation so that the attitude changes are done with the reaction control system about the roll axis. And we managed to be able to do this without much of a penalty. The communications with Earth and data transmission will have been maintained on each pass in front of the Moon. During periods when the spacecraft is behind the Moon, data is recorded on board for subsequent playback when the line of sight is reacquired. Separation is performed by the Lunar Module Reaction Control System about 5 seconds of burn, and this occurs about 30 minutes prior to the actual time of lunar module transfer orbit insertion. The separation delta V is small, about a foot a second, and it's done so that the two vehicles drift apart very gradually. When the vehicles are about 60 feet apart, the lunar module will pitch up so that an attitude which allows the command module crewman visibility to inspect with the sextant, by looking out the sextant, he can inspect the external portions of the lunar module, including the landing gear and probes, to understand if they are adequately deployed and so forth. This slide doesn't show those probes on the pads here, so he'd have some comment on that, I guess. A few minutes later, the vehicles are far enough apart to perform a checkout of the rendezvous radar and the command service module transponder. Also during this separated period, the lunar module platform is fine aligned. The controls and displays are checked out, and the lunar module, in the lunar module alone configuration, they would have been checked out in the attached configuration earlier, and then preparations are made for the transfer orbit insertion. Now, before the lunar module passed out of line of sight of the Earth, data transmission and voice communications had been maintained directly using the lunar module high-gain antenna. After losing line of sight, the lunar module data will be transmitted to the command service module, where it is recorded for subsequent playback. This will be the situation during all phases when the lunar module is behind the Moon, since it carries no onboard data recorder of its own. The separation maneuver was made in such a direction as to place the lunar module ahead and below the CSM throughout the 30 minutes coast prior to the transfer orbit insertion point. This type of separation maneuver avoids the possibility of jet impingement or collision during the transfer burn by increasing the lunar module command service module range for small delta V as compared to the forward or rearward separation methods. Another advantage is that it provides clear VHF communications between the command service module and the lunar module during the coast and during the transfer maneuver. Now, the two vehicles are about a quarter of a mile apart at the time of transfer orbit insertion. Prior to the engine burn, propellant settling is provided by a 5 seconds RCS firing of the four-axis thrusters. The insertion maneuver takes place behind the Moon about 200 degrees central angle from the landing site. Descent engine thrust is maintained at 30% for the first 8 seconds and is then reduced to 10% for the next 23 seconds and is then increased to 92.5%, which is about 9,700 pounds, for the final 6 seconds of burn. Now, you'll wonder why that complicated startup cycle. This period of low, the period of low thrust is required due to the possibility that the vehicle CG deviates from its nominal location and the engine thrust vector is not acting through the CG. Now, since the engine gimbals are used in the case of the lunar module for trim control only and are relatively slow, the engine thrust is reduced to ensure that the moment control of the reaction control system is not exceeded during the initial travel. Now, the high thrust at the end of the burn enables us to make a check on the engine through its full throttling range. The fuel expended during the insertion maneuver is about 330 pounds, and the corresponding delta V is slightly less than 100 feet a second. We are now on our next plateau, which is coasting descent. And at this point, the lunar module is in a slowly descending coast trajectory, which will continue for about the next hour until it reaches its paracynthian altitude of 50,000 feet. During this period, the lunar module will track the command service module with its rendezvous radar and determine its descent trajectory on board. Similarly, the command module can track the lunar module flashing light with its sextant and perform an independent determination of the lunar module orbit. Now, finally, when the lunar module comes within line of sight of the Earth, then the ground station will track the vehicle and provide the lunar module with the final source of navigation data. As in all operations we have discussed up to this point, the ground-based navigation is the primary source of data. If the decision is made not to initiate powered descent, the lunar module is in a safe orbit from which it could subsequently rendezvous with the CSM, or if necessary, the CSM could perform a rescue. Having decided to continue descent, however, another IMU alignment will be made, and preparations for powered descent will begin. Up to this point in the coasting descent, the lunar module has been leading the command service module. At paracynthian, this lead angle is about 10 degrees. From this point on, however, once the lunar module begins powered descent, the command service module will catch up and finally go ahead of the lunar module during the latter part of the landing maneuver. Mr. Cheatham will cover the powered descent in detail, so we'll describe it only real briefly. The powered descent is divided into three distinct portions called the braking phase and the final approach phase and the landing phase. Phase one, the braking phase, is designed primarily for efficient reduction of the orbital velocity and therefore performed at maximum thrust with near horizontal flight path angles. Now, it's the longest of the three phases, lasting about 8 minutes while covering about 250 miles down to an altitude of about 8,600 feet. Phase two of the final approach phase begins at the 8,600-foot point called Highgate. About 8 nautical miles range from the landing site. It begins with a pitch maneuver which brings the horizon and the landing site into the pilot's field of view for the first time. Phase three of the landing phase is designed specifically for pilot control and provides the capability for making a detailed assessment of the landing site. The vehicle is pitched back to a near vertical attitude. The thrust is reduced, vertical and horizontal velocities are reduced, and the vertical descent is made from the last 100 feet altitude. A duration of this phase is nominally about 75 seconds, but the capability exists to extend it longer if more landing site assessment time or small redesignations are required, largely according to how much propellant we are able to carry in reserve here. This is the final descent, which is shown vertically, and depending on what the dust situation is like, it'll be observed, and the man will be using visual cues, or he will possibly have to be using his automatic landing systems. Now, at this point, we are on the next plateau, which is largely why we went there. We're here for a lunar stay now, and following an assessment of the vehicle situation to determine if there is a necessity for an early abort, the post-landing checkout has begun, which is rather extensive. The descent engine is disarmed, and the descent propellant tanks are vented. The IMU is aligned and placed on a standby operation. Systems not required during the lunar surface stay are shut down completely. Following a period of coordination with the ground, a thorough check out of the extravehicular mobility unit is performed, and an EMU, or the extravehicular mobility unit, is donned by both crewmen, and preparations are made for egress. Life support is switched to the portable life support system, and the cabin is depressurized, and the forward hatch is open. This occurs about 1 3/4 hours after landing. The lunar surface stay time on the first mission is planned for approximately 18 hours. During this time, 2 3-hour expiration periods are provided for each astronaut to be done simultaneously for a total of 12 man-hours of lunar surface activity. Now, the scientific objectives and activities will be the subject of a later paper. Briefly summarizing the timeline, it allows for 2 3-hour explorations with a total of 12 man-hours on the surface outside the lunar module. A 6-hour sleep period is provided between the excursions. Now, returning to the lunar module, following the last exploration period, the pre-launch checkout is conducted, wherein all systems are activated, checked out, and prepared for launch. The rendezvous radar will have been checked out by tracking the command service module on its pass over the landing site prior to launch. Ascent engine ignition will occur at the beginning of the 3.5-minute launch window, when the command service module leads the lunar module by about 10 degrees. The ascent engine propellant tanks are pressurized, and the propellant valves are open. The structural ties and umbilical between the descent and ascent stage are severed by explosive charges. To continue with our ascent, however, after the engine shutdown, the lunar module acquires and tracks the command service module with the rendezvous radar to determine its own orbit. At this point, the command service module is still leading the lunar module and is about 350 miles away. The ground has been tracking the lunar module during the entire ascent and continues to do so. Based on this tracking, a determination will be made of the next maneuver to be performed some 30 minutes after beginning of coast. This next maneuver is called the concentric sequence initiation, or CSI. It is a relatively small maneuver made with the reaction control system jets and is designed to raise the paracentian of the lunar module orbit to an altitude consistent with that required for proper phasing with the CSM. At the same time, it is somewhat like a mid-course correction in that it will be calculated to absorb the trajectory dispersions resulting from the main ascent. Now, depending on our landing site longitude, we have probably lost line of sight with the Earth at this point. The lunar module to command service module range has been reduced to slightly less than 200 nautical miles at the concentric sequence initiation point, with the command service module leading. The lunar module continues to track the command service module with the rendezvous radar, and preparations are made for the next step in the ascent sequence, which will occur when the lunar module reaches the high point of its new orbit about 50 minutes after concentric sequence initiation. Another maneuver is made which circularizes the lunar module orbit at 65 nautical miles. This is for the on-time launch case. such that the lunar module and CSM orbits are concentric and separated by an altitude of 15 nautical miles. Actual range to the CSM is about 50 nautical miles at this point. Now, following the circularization maneuver, the lunar module continues to track the command service module and shortly emerges from behind the moon, at which time tracking from the ground station is resumed. Now, based on the lunar module onboard tracking and ground-based tracking, the conditions are determined for the next maneuver, called the terminal phase initiation, or TPI maneuver. This maneuver is made about 20 to 30 minutes from the time we began the circular orbit and is designed to place the lunar module on an intercept trajectory with the CSM about 140 degrees away from initiation. The range to the CSM is about 30 nautical miles at the initiation of the transfer maneuver. During the next 35 minutes, the range to the CSM will be reduced from 30 nautical miles to about 3 nautical miles, and the range rates to the CSM will go from about 130 feet a second to about 30 feet a second. A series of range and range rate gates are specified such that at the 3 nautical mile point, an RCS burn reduces the range rate to 20 feet a second, and at a 1 nautical mile range, a short burn reduces the range rate to 10 feet a second. At 500 feet, the rate's down to 5 feet a second. And these burns are all in the range of 4 to 8 seconds and consume a total of about 20 pounds of propellant. Having passed this last gate, I had the wrong slide on there for some time. Having passed this last gate, the vehicles are in close proximity at a low relative velocity, and the manual docking phase begins. The capability exists for docking in darkness, since the lights are provided on the docking target. Lights are provided, and the docking targets themselves are luminescent. However, in most cases, we will prefer to wait a few minutes until the vehicles come into sunlight. The relative rates of the two vehicles will be nulled at this time. At a range of about 50 feet, the lunar module will be pitched back so that the command module becomes visible in the overhead window. The pilot then translates toward the CSM at a low rate and engages the command module probe and the lunar module drogue. The docking tunnel is pressurized, the upper hatches are removed, and the docking latches are secured. We are now in another plateau, and we have the ability to remain in this plateau for extended periods of time if we desire. However, normally, we will proceed on to the next point within a few hours. During the next hour or so, the lunar module is deactivated, and the crew and equipment are transferred to the command service module, and finally, the lunar module is jettisoned by firing a shaped charge which separates the command module and lunar module and allows us to translate away from the lunar module with the service module reaction control system jets. We are now only an hour away from an opportunity for trans-Earth injection, but we will not try to make the first opportunity since systems readiness checks, exchange of data with the Earth, and IMU alignment have not yet been performed. So we go for another orbit before trans-Earth injection. A trans-Earth injection occurs on the backside of the moon with respect to the Earth and will normally be in the dark. The SPS burn is preceded by a 14-second ullage burn from the service module reaction control system to settle the propellants in the tanks. Now, this ullage maneuver was not required on our previous SPS burns on the way to the moon since the tanks are essentially full, but now they are only about one-third full. There is a possibility that a capability for zero-G no ullage starts could exist. We're investigating it, but it hasn't been established yet. Trans-Earth injection delta-V will vary from about 2,600 feet a second up to about 3,200 feet a second, depending on whether we are returning at a relatively slow 110 hours or a relatively fast 86-hour transfer trajectory. The 24-hour flexibility is necessary to allow a return to the primary recovery area on Earth in the vicinity of Hawaii for the missions. A typical value for propellant consumed, I'll leave that on, it's not supposed to be on yet, but I'll leave it there. Typical propellant value for propellant consumed during the trans-Earth injection is about 8,000 pounds with an SPS burn time of about 2 minutes. Soon after the end of the burn, the spacecraft comes within line of sight of the Earth and continuous tracking begins. Data recorded on board the CSM during the injection burn is played back to the ground station. CSM is powered down, and the passive thermal control maneuver is initiated, and the crew goes to sleep. We are now on another mission plateau, which is called Trans-Earth Coast. Operations during the Trans-Earth Coast phase are similar to those described during Trans-Lunar Coast, with some notable exceptions. First, the position of the Sun relative to the trans-Earth trajectory will be such as to result in high-gain antenna communications loss during each revolution of our thermal control maneuver. A typical values for a 2.5 revolution per hour roll rate would be loss of Earth for 4 minutes out of every 24-minute revolution. As we mentioned in the previous discussion, this is not considered a problem, since the ground can contact the spacecraft at any time and request that a communications attitude be held. Also, it is likely that voice and low bitrate telemetry can be maintained over the Omni antennas for much of the trans-Earth phase. The other major difference from the trans-lunar phase concerns the mid-course corrections. In this case, it is almost certain that the corrections will need to be made with the service module reaction control system. The spacecraft is considerably lighter now, but the minimum impulse capability of the service propulsion system is the same. So the minimum delta V, which can be performed with the SPS, is like 12 feet a second now. Adding 5 feet a second to this for the ullage maneuver results in the fact that the mid-course correction must be at least 17 feet a second before it can be performed by the SPS. Error analysis of the MSFN tracking capability and the SPS cutoff errors indicate that the corrections will be considerably less than 17 feet a second. Hence, the plan will be to perform these corrections with the service module reaction control system. Now, as in the translunar case, two corrections will probably suffice. The first one would be about 10 hours after injection, and the second about 2 hours before entry. About 15 minutes prior to the entry interface at about 400,000 feet, the service module is jettisoned when the spacecraft is some 2,500 nautical miles from the Earth. The spacecraft is oriented for service module jettison in such a way that the 3.5 feet a second separation velocity applied by the service module reaction control system jets places it on a path which minimizes the probability of subsequent recontact with the command module. The command module then is oriented to the entry attitude using its own reaction control system jets. Entry will normally begin over the western Pacific at about 400,000 feet altitude. Range from this point to splashdown will be 1,500 to 2,500 nautical miles and will be controlled by varying the direction and the time application of the spacecraft lift vector by using the command module reaction control roll jets. A ground-based station at Guam or in Australia, depending on the inclination of the approach path, will track the spacecraft just prior to entry. But the entry phase itself will normally not be in line of sight of a ground-based station. Tracking during entry will be provided by two ships positioned along the entry path. This ensures that tracking is continuous during this period. Now, Earth Earth landing sequence begins at 24,000 feet. The forward heat shield... Well, we aren't ready to jettison anything yet. The forward heat shield is jettisoned, which exposes the command module bay where the parachutes are stored. The two drogue chutes are deployed immediately thereafter and are disreefed a few seconds later. Both these pictures are, this is drogues and this is drogues. One is reefed and one is disreefed. This reduces the velocity from about 400 feet a second to 200 feet a second, and you're down to 10,000 feet where the main chutes are deployed. Three pilot chutes pull out the three main chutes, and the drogue chutes are disconnected. A few seconds later, the main chutes are disreefed, and the descent rate is reduced to about 25 feet a second, and this is the situation at splashdown. Recovery soon is effected, and the crew and spacecraft are taken aboard the ship. It was interesting to the technical illustrators that the command module was all black now. It's covered with a blater, as you probably all know, and it ablates. On the lunar mission, it would very likely ablate all the way around. This is, on this particular side, is the lee side on reentry, and on the 201 mission, spacecraft 9, did not ablate on this side. It just ablated around to about here. So I had a hard time explaining that that was going to be dark. I'd like to conclude with, I've got a couple of more slides on the velocity budget and the weights, and this ought to tie it off. Here we have shown the velocity budgets for the service module and for the lunar excursion module, the values that have been used, and you might hear these referred to later as the specification values are over here and here and here and here. And some of the rationale behind why those are what they are indicated on these charts. It's broken down by phase because the in the case of the command service module on the translunar phase, you have to recognize, of course, that the lunar module is with it, very large mass. And in the trans-Earth phase, the command service module is by itself. So we have to talk about these budgets in terms of those phases. The LEM rescue is a contingency situation and therefore is treated separately. It is done in the same configuration as the trans-Earth. And so this is why they're broken down this way. Some of the considerations for... the translunar budget being in excess of the minimum possible are that we're providing for, we have provisions in there for everyday launch opportunity, free return trajectories, lunar landing site flexibility, and translunar and lunar orbit trim. Obviously, this is indicating that if you kind of had everything your own way, that you could possibly do it with just that much. And these are the three sigma dispersions, and then we just add them up here. And similarly, it's indicated why it is that the... in the case of the LEM rescue, this is a little different. There's a situation requiring any time lunar module launch, or dealing with any time lunar module launch, which takes a fair amount more propellant for the LEM rescue by the command service module. The lunar module in 50,000-foot orbit, this is the orbit to which the command service module will have to go. And there's consideration for the command service module to complete the rendezvous and docking within 11 hours. Now, it costs you a fair amount of reaction control system to complete the docking, so that we often count on the, even though the rescue would have to be done by the CSM, we'd count on the lunar module to do the docking to help us out in our reaction control system budget. For the allowing, giving us the flexibility for trans-Earth, we talk about return from lunar orbit conditions as defined in this situation, and 24-hour transfer time variation in order to acquire our desired landing site in the around Hawaii, and also to get within, well, Hawaii is within the 40-degree maximum return inclination, but that is another requirement that we'd put on. Even if we couldn't get to Hawaii, we would like to get within the 40-degree inclination. And some of the considerations, this is the minimum possible for the LEM descent, and some of the considerations that lead to the difference are the flexibility for the altitude variations, landing area observation, changing landing site location, and so forth. And in the ascent, there aren't so many considerations because it it doesn't have as many uncertainties or many flexibilities that you'd like to have as the descent does, because you're thinking about things of looking for a good landing site when you're using the descent engine. The flexibility in the ascent is for lunar launch window, command service module altitude variations, ascent trajectory trim of 2 degrees orbit for an orbit plane change, and for the docking itself. Now, those give you an indication about what has gone into the velocity budget. And with that budget, we generate an understanding of the weights based on, in this column here, in this chart here, the command service module weights, the total vehicle weights, and over here is a breakdown of the lunar excursion module weights. And we have where it says command module including crew, this is the inert weight of the command, well, it's the total command module. Service module inert, a service module bay payload, there's an open bay in the service module where one could carry additional payload. Service propulsion system propellant is broken out separately, and this is for the RCS, for the delta, or for the velocity budget that we spoke of earlier. And the lunar module, not including the crew, is, we always have these little notes because they've got to be in one or the other, and so the weight statement is always put together like this. Service module, lunar module adapter. Now, what we've got here is the current estimate of the weights, the predicted weights, and what the maximum weight is that one ought to be thinking about. Like, for instance, that one is, we've only got a factor of safety of 1.2 on the Earth landing system. If the weight gets any higher than that, that factor would be getting out of hand. So there are considerations of that nature that lead to saying what the maximum weights are. We can perform the lunar mission scan that was spoken of earlier, where we identified all those points we could land on the moon and the dates that we could land on it. Was done with a 95,000-pound vehicle, which is in between these two, and performed the same velocity budget with a 1%, I think it was, a propellant reserve. This is indicating that with weights higher than this, since we performed the same velocity budget, we can end up with a propellant reserve, and depending on what the inert weights are, what they, how much you really end up growing here and here and so forth, you can have more or less reserve. Now, recent discussions with the headquarters and Marshall people, there was a at least an interim agreement that we would think about weights of this size, of this magnitude, for mission planning purposes, although some investigation has to be conducted to understand whether or not we collectively with Marshall have the capability really to do this. One of the other things that Marshall is looking at is the ability of the launch vehicle to perform with a 100,000-pound payload, largely of a structural type problem. But they, I understand, are conducting analysis in that area now. That concludes the detailed presentation that I had planned, and I don't know how I did on time, but I guess I ran over.
We have about 10 to 15 minutes if anyone wants to experiment with how a discussion goes in a group like this on a topic like we've just been through. General Phillips' question related to the recycle time on the Saturn V and whether we looked at it enough to be sure that we do indeed have a 48-hour recycle capability.
Well, there has been some look at this, but I think that the point is very well taken that it needs to be investigated to really understand that we have this. I believe we do, but I'm sure that this should be an action that we should take away to go and understand that we really have this, not only for the launch vehicle, but for the spacecraft as well. We've got cryogenics on board, recycle problems with them. The supercritical helium system on the LEM descent stage would be a contender for a problem. I'm just not certain about those things. I understand from the investigations done to date that we have this capability, but it sure should be investigated, yes.
Lyle, just log an item. There is a study which was done, I guess, by Washington. It's in circulation, and what we need to do is to be sure that gets commented on by the centers and we tie this down. It obviously has interaction back into the whole planning cycle. Walter, I think I know what you're going to ask, but go ahead. Dr. Hauserman's question relates to going direct ascent to translunar injection rather than the pause in Earth parking orbit. He points out that the total operating time of the launch vehicle is less, and therefore you might conclude its reliability would be higher, and there is also a payload gain.
Well, I think that one of the things that we would be trading off against those good things would be We have an opportunity in Earth orbit to check out the vehicle. It has had the major energy expended against it. When we look at those plateaus, it's had a lot of propellant put into it, shaking it and so forth. It's gone through a real good test of its systems and so forth. And that in Earth orbit, you're sitting there and you've gone through a really major part of the burn, and you would like to understand what kind of a situation you're in before you proceed to the next one. I think that would be the only thing that...
I think the question is really a good one if the trajectories can accommodate it. I think Pete Frank or somebody ought to comment on it from a trajectory point of view. I'm not sure that the additional checkout you do in Earth orbit is really anything more than an intellectual concept. You've done a pretty damn good checkout on the ground, and whether you impart a delta V of 25,000 feet per second or 35, I don't think it makes a hell of a lot of difference in terms of the reliability of the hardware. We've got to have cleaned out any problems of interaction with the environment before we start to fly the lunar mission, and we'll be picking those up on the 1Bs and the 5s that are the rehearsal mission. So I think the concept of the checkout part of the spacecraft after it gets to Earth orbit or after the first two stages of burn is less significant than say trajectory implications of the thing. Walter? Okay, the as Dr. Hausman understands it, the main limitation is launch window and lighting restrictions. I guess at launch it must be, huh? I'm not that detail familiar with trajectory stuff. I think that Pete Frank is probably the guy who's best able to comment on it. He comes up this afternoon, and we'll nail him again and be sure he's able to talk to it. I think I'd make one more generalization off that question. There are several places where, as Owen went through his mission description, we were taking two orbits or three orbits to do something that you might have done essentially continuously. I don't think that in areas like that this represents any kind of firm decision or position at the present time. It's a relatively conservative way to lay out the timeline. And those kinds of things I'm pretty sure will juggle slightly between now and the actual mission. It turns out when you get down to the time of writing the mission rules and really getting in hard on the timeline and what you're going to do, that's the point where you crystallize these things. Much of what we're talking about here is the capability that exists and the kind of extremes that you can go to. Oren? Mr. Nix wants to know what happens to the S-4B after it's jettisoned. We're only pulling away initially at a velocity of about 3.5 feet per second. I have heard talk in the past about using the ground command to turn the S-4B and just essentially run it to depletion to give it a kick out of the way. I don't know where we stand in the overall mission on that sort of thing.
I don't know what the... Well, yeah, this would be a good thing to do, certainly. I think the investigations that there have been investigations conducted that say that even the 3 feet a second is statistically sufficient to prevent you from colliding with the S-4B. But you'd feel a lot more comfortable if you got rid of it completely, I think.
I think we need to. I'm sure the capability exists in the vehicle. I think it was there. It's sort of inherent in it.
I think one of the points that would have to be considered there certainly would be the have to maintain communications to do this and the maneuver. And of course, at this point, you're at rather extreme range. You'd be on the narrow band of the high gain antenna and so forth. So it'd be a little tricky to do it. And, so I think that we're kind of obligated to watch out for it as well.
Anybody else? You must all be hungry. Okay, lunch is scheduled in the cafeteria. It's walking distance. I don't think there'll be any need for buses or anything like that. It's a serve-yourself kind of cafeteria. We'll see you back here at 1:15.
You want it?
Gentlemen, will you take your seats, please, so we can get on with this program? We're already 5 minutes over the announced time to reconvene.